In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Welcome. So glad you're joining us today because it is our annual 4th of July show. Have you ever thought about how we really know about history? I mean, how do you know what really truly happened? After all, we only truly know for certain the events and experiences within our own lifetime. If it were not for the written word and the integrity of those writing it to do so accurately, we'd have no means to know what was in their hearts and minds as they experienced the events of their lives and times, which becomes our history. Archaeology, of course, can tell you about buildings and other physical details, but it leaves a very incomplete picture in the sense it gives generalities, and often those are up to the interpretation of the digger, but not specifics of what those people thought or believed, their hopes and dreams, their fears. It fell on them to explain, in writing, the whys and hows of their days. And that's why it's so important to safeguard history from those who would subvert it, politicize it, project their own weird fantasies onto it, and reinterpret it to something it wasn't. Things like the 1619 Project aren't just dangerous because they pervert history into blaming America. It's dangerous because it seeks to erase the reality of what happened. History becomes part of who we are and informs not just our yesterdays and present, but shapes our future. If we know our forefathers fought the most powerful nation on earth and won their freedom from an oppressive monarch, it helps us see and believe that we too can fight to win back and keep our freedoms. And make no mistake, America is under assault from those who not only want to rob us of our future, but rob us of our past. We often talk about the Founding Fathers, but we don't often talk about the Founding Fathers. Many of our past 4th of July shows have focused on the Declaration of Independence, the arguments for it, the conditions that led up to it, but we haven't ever really focused on the signers themselves, what led them to be there, and to put their names on this most sacred writing in America's history. Greg Leo has been our guest for all of our annual 4th of July shows. He is a consultant for government and a civic activist in his day job, but his real passion is history, and we love talking to him around the 4th of July. Greg, I can't believe another year has flown by.
You know, time flies when we're having fun, Mark. It's great to be back, and isn't it great to celebrate our country on the 4th of July?
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. You know, so many of our past shows, and we're now into our 11th season here, some of our past shows have focused on the 4th in the first 50 years, celebrating the 4th on the then western frontier of Indiana and the Northwest Territories, the westward expansion in the 4th of and celebrating the 4th on the Oregon Trail, and the first truly big celebration of the Declaration of Independence, the 50th anniversary. Last year, in the middle of riots pulling down statues of historical figures, we focused on Ulysses S. Grant. And this year, I thought it would be fun to look at some of the signers themselves, what got them there, their unique stories. Were they really as united as we tend to think now, and what became of them? But let's set the stage a bit and talk about some of the immediate history leading up to the Declaration. The Declaration was signed by the Second Continental Congress, but what can you tell us about the First Continental Congress, which met in 1774? Why were they meeting?
Well, they were meeting really because of the British threat and primarily what had happened up in Massachusetts, you know, where the Revolutionary War really broke out. And so the British authority had tightened up control on the colonies, had put in the Stamp Act and, of course, other kinds of, we know about the tea in the harbor, but basically were looking for revenue ways to pay for the costs of the previous, you know, French and Indian wars. And so anyway, it was an overreach, tightening up on civil liberties for the colonies that really brought this about. So, and it was not decided. I mean, many Americans at that time did not agree that they should leave the mother country. And so it was highly controversial, but it was something that they knew. They had addressed the British Crown for redress of grievances and had not received a good response. In fact, all of those best arguments Jefferson wrote into the Declaration. And so when we read the Declaration out loud today, we hear the protest and all the specific points that brought them to Philadelphia.
It had formed, the First Continental Congress had formed in 1774. The opening shots of the war were on April 19th, 1775. Some of the accomplishments from that First Continental Congress was really they had two primary accomplishments, as I understand it. The first was to create a boycott of British goods beginning on December 1st, 1774. And actually, it was very successful. Imports from Britain dropped by 97% in 1775 compared with the previous year. And then the second accomplishment was to provide for the second one. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about that second Continental Congress?
Well, the idea was to have a unified front against the increasing authority. And so the stamp tax and the tax on paper, the tax on window panes, all of the different taxes that the British Crown brought really stirred people up, that not only did they not have their grievances listened to, that mm-hmm. they had to go far away to get any kind of justice or even a hearing. But then the increase of taxes, I think, brought them all together to say, well, what can we do in a combined way about this? But again, this was not like a groundswell where everyone agreed. It was very, contentious. A lot of Americans did not want to rebel against the crown. They were Tories. Many of the folks were very concerned about what the implications might be on their trade and on business. So basically, it was a stirred up time. They brought themselves together, and eventually tried to find some commonality. It really wasn't until they wrote the document, mm-hmm. and the document, in a sense, became a catalyst for everyone to come together and actually decide to, declare independence and actually pick a fight with the greatest military power in the world.
Yeah, which in retrospect seems a little crazy at the time. The first Congress had, in response to the passage of the Intolerable Acts, they had petitioned the king, tried to smooth things over. And then the second Continental Congress, because of the ineffectiveness of the first petition, they also filed the Olive Branch petition. So in a sense, the Declaration was actually the third time's the charm, and this time we mean it petition. But talk to us a bit about the Olive Branch petition, because, and this was written in the summer of 1775, some 2 months after the opening shot at Lexington. And talk to us why this petition failed.
Well, there was a hope that they would not have to really fight the war, and that this was the opportunity to try to get the British to negotiate, to sit down, basically to try to resolve some of these conflicts. But it was rebuffed. And mostly, I think, because King George didn't feel that it was that the colonial powers had the authority to challenge British authority. And so they did exactly what you shouldn't do as a tyrant in that situation. They actually tightened up and, started to levy more taxes and have less access to justice and other kinds of hearings. So the Olive Branch failed, but the Olive Branch, the fact that it was offered, said that, the colonials were reasonable and were trying to work it out. And a lot of people needed to hear that.
Yep. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. Come back. We'll have more with Greg Leo of the Leo Company. It's our annual 4th of July show. Stay with us as we continue to look at the signers of the Declaration of Independence.
You're listening to the I Spy Radio Show.
And welcome back. It's our annual 4th of July show. We're doing that with Greg Leo, who's always our guest for these. Greg is a consultant for government and a civic activist in his day job, but his real passion is history. You can find out more about Greg by heading to theleocompany.com, and we'll link that up on ispyradio.com as well. And so, Greg, we're talking today about the signers of the Declaration of Independence. But before we get there, it's really such a fascinating history as to what led up to that. And just to go back to the Olive Branch petition, because I had either forgotten about this or just, barely knew much about it. But one of the reasons why they wanted to offer this to the king was because, you know, after winning the French and Indian War, literally putting their lives on the line, they felt that the king did not thank the colonists for their support and participation in that war, and instead just levied a whole bunch of taxes and new laws on them, which seemed more like a punishment. And so it was essentially the colonists said, you know, we supported you, and then you come in and abuse us and make us pay for your war.
Yeah, and there was a lot of lives lost. It was the French and Indian War was bloody, particularly on the frontier. And the response was, well, a kind and generous king should thank us for our service to the crown. And instead, they got the tax on tea, the tax on lead, the tax on window panes, the tax on paper, the tax on playing cards. It was basically the British crown saying, no, we want to raise the revenues that we spent in the war. It wasn't enough that, that they won the war and that we'd made the sacrifice. So that's why the rebuff of the olive branch was so hard on the colonials and actually got people to be more concerned.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but in order to finance the French and Indian War, the king borrowed in order to do that, right? And so he was essentially now having to pay back all of those loans. Am I remembering that correctly?
No, that's exactly right. And so, they had to go to financial markets and try to raise the money from the landed gentry. Remember, England, it's a maritime power, and it's also, got a lot of trade worldwide. But the point is that the king didn't really have the money to fight the war. It was an expensive, long-term geopolitical struggle with France, which actually ended up determining the end of the American Revolution a decade or so later. And, of course, became part of the Napoleonic Wars. So this long-term conflict with France is as much of a geopolitical reason as it was the Americans' love for freedom and interest in breaking off.
And of course, back then, you didn't just print money. I mean, it was actual gold and silver that you used for your coinage. You weren't just printing money like we do now, where we just add a few zeros to our deficit. So, one of the other things that was interesting about the Olive Branch Petition is the king never actually read it. They had sent a delegate. They had sent two people over there, and the king just refused to read it because by the time they had arrived, he had already issued a proclamation of rebellion on August 23rd of that year, which was saying that basically we're at war here with the colonists. And it was the start of asking for troops and more money to now go after the colonists themselves.
Exactly. And had the exact opposite effect, accelerated the conflict. So maybe this is why John Hancock wrote his signature so large on the declaration. They asked him, why did he do that? He said, so it's large enough for King George to be able to see it.
Yeah. So a year later, after that was sent, they had the Second Continental Congress met again. This was in, I think, May of 1776. And they had resolved to declare independence and go to war. But even just getting to the Declaration of Independence, we've got this perception of a united front, but there was more than a few delegates that were opposed to the Declaration of Independence, weren't there?
It was a long and difficult discussion over a hot summer, a lot of disagreement. Altogether, there were 56 people who signed, 14 from New England, 21 from the middle colonies, 21 from the South. Very diverse, had lots of different interests. Some of them were in conflict commercially. There was a conflict, of course, over slavery. And so there was lots of sectional type conflicts between folks. And there just was not the understanding that this would be necessary to have a long war. So there was, I think, concerns about how the conflict with England would affect commerce and development, and of course, the British sending troops. So it was not a clear decision. It took a long time to come to it. And I think that's probably why, Ben Franklin said, it's a republic if we can keep it.
Yeah. I really didn't know that the New Jersey delegates seemed to be especially reluctant. I know that, and what was interesting in there too was that some of them end up having to be replaced, but I think we'll come back around to that. In terms of the delegates themselves to the Second Continental Congress, there were some 65-ish delegates, depending on how and when you count, although Georgia apparently arrived rather late. With the 13 colonies, between them, that's an average of 4.3 delegates per colony. Pennsylvania had the most with 9, followed by Virginia with 7. Most of them had, as I said, about four. Delaware, Georgia, North Carolina, New Hampshire all had three, and Little Rhode Island only had two. So how was the number of delegates determined?
Basically by population. And so they're trying to make sure that there's a balance between big states and small states. And of course, we saw that worked out in later compromises. But they were looking to see that every section of the country was represented and that it was balanced in a way that, the rest of the country wasn't subservient to Boston or to New York or any of the bigger urban centers. And so even the fact they're in Philadelphia was a bit of a compromise because, frankly, there wasn't as much support from that part as there was from the Northeast that had actually come to blows previously. So it was a compromise. And when they got there, there was largely disagreement, lots of conflict, but there was also a lot of conversations. And so it basically boiled down to the committee that was appointed to actually write the Constitution. That created kind of a catalyst, I think, for making sure we could get everybody on board. Some of the brightest minds in American history, Jefferson, of course, is there, and they wrote a document which could bring people together.
Yeah. Well, as I said, some of the delegates actually had to be replaced. And even mm-hmm. then, not all of the delegates actually signed. Of the 65, only 56 congressional delegates in total signed the document, including some of them who were not present at the vote actually approving the declaration. Delegates Thomas Willing and Charles Humphrey voted against the resolution of independence and were replaced in Pennsylvania. Before the August 2nd signing, John Alsop actually favored reconciliation and resigned rather than sign. And then you had John Dickinson of Pennsylvania, James Duane, Robert Livingston, John Jay of New York, all refused to sign. Carter Braxton of Virginia, Robert Morris of Pennsylvania, George Reed of Delaware, and Edward Rutledge of South Carolina opposed the document, but they did end up signing anyway, just to give the impression of a unanimous Congress there. So, okay, we're up against the clock. Let's go ahead and take a break here. Coming back, we'll have more on the signers. Stay with us. More with Greg Leo. And welcome back. It is our annual 4th of July show. We're talking with our regular guest for these annual shows, Greg Leo. He is a government consultant, and you can find out more about him by heading to theleocompany.com. We'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. And Greg, let's turn now to some of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. The average age at signing was 44 and a half years old. The oldest at the signing was Benjamin Franklin at age 70. The youngest was Edward Rutledge at 26, who was just a few months older than Thomas Lynch Jr., who was also 26. I mean, can you imagine being a 26-year-old, being there and putting your name to this to go to war with the greatest power on earth? And that seems almost insane.
Remarkable. And they all came from very diverse but interesting backgrounds. 24 were either lawyers or jurists. Mm-hmm. There were 11 who were merchants. 9 were farmers or plantation owners. These were people largely who were educated, which at the time they did not have broad education in the country. So these were the ones that actually knew about how things work. They were largely well-educated and people who were leaders in their own states. And so they brought with them all of those different values that they would have in different parts of the country. Not all of the colonies were the same. The Northeast was certainly more maritime and trade oriented, and the South was more agrarian and slave oriented.
Yeah.
So it was a very diverse, and they brought these values there and were in conflict. And the conflicts caused people to leave, and some people stayed. And the point is that eventually they learned that they could work together if they because the stakes were so high. And so the one thing that they said in the document that I think really sums it up is they pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor, which is a full-time commitment. And those folks really did put it on the line for our freedom.
Hmm. There was also 8 non-natives, all born in the British Isles. I didn't know that until I started looking into that. But it was England, Ireland, and Scotland, and one from Wales. But that was, I found that to be interesting, is they were first generation immigrants here. And they, even though they grew up in England, they still decided to make the break anyway.
And they came for the promise of a new land and, frankly, the freedom. And they'd enjoyed freedom here. You know, also, they had the risk of, you know, living on the frontier where there were constant wars and battles and, you know, war against wilderness in a way. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so needing the protection of the crown was really important. And so after the French-American War, French and Indian War, I should say, there was, I think the desire that there be some kind of protection. And so if the crown was not going to cooperate and there was this idea of independence, then they needed to rely on each other. So I think that's where this idea of e pluribus unum came from, that from many one, and that will protect each other by show of arms and also through force of law.
Hmm. Among the delegates that were missing and were not there at the signing were Generals George Washington, John Sullivan, James Clinton, and also Christopher Gadsden, and Virginia Governor Patrick Henry. And it's a shame that they didn't get their names on the document, you know, even though they were delegates. But, you know, they're out there in the early stages of the war, and there was a lot to be prepared for even then, wasn't there?
Well, and Patrick Henry, of course, had played the important role of bringing the Virginia, you know, House of Burgesses together and just been the catalyst, really, for the desire for freedom in Virginia. George Washington, of course, was running the plantation and really at first didn't like the idea of it. He had been a general in the French and Indian Wars and had worked with Braddock, you know, in the incursion into the Appalachians. But I think, you know, after they met, he came around. And of course, when he showed up there, he was probably the most experienced military guy in the country.
Right.
But it's a trivia question, but he did not sign the Declaration.
No, he didn't. So let's talk about some of the signers, starting with the big one, John Hancock. And we mentioned him earlier, but many of the same 56 delegates who attended and end up signing the document were who had attended the First Continental Congress, I should say, were in attendance at the second one and ended up signing the documents. The delegates at the time had appointed the same president as the first one, Peyton Randolph, and Secretary Charles Thompson. Notable new arrivals at the Second Continental Congress included Benjamin Franklin of Pennsylvania and John Hancock. Within 2 weeks, President Peyton Randolph was summoned back to Virginia to preside over its House of Burgesses that you just mentioned. Henry Middleton was elected as president to replace Randolph, but he declined. And so Hancock ended up being elected president. So how did a new arrival like that essentially get to be elected president?
This was a guy who was larger than life in some ways. You know, he had been a very successful merchant. Some say that John Hancock had actually done quite a bit of smuggling because he was avoiding the British tariffs on the goods. But he was a guy who was a natural born leader and was able to pull people together. So, of course, he went on to serve in the Revolutionary War as a major general, elected governor of Massachusetts afterwards. And it really, the guy who had the kind of leadership from the front to be able to sign the document first, kind of make a joke about why it was so large, but show that strong commitment that, you know, that is true leadership.
Yeah. Well, he was orphaned as a child, from what I saw, and was adopted by a wealthy merchant uncle who was childless. And he put him through Harvard College for a business education and graduated at the age of 17, which is pretty amazing. In 1763, his uncle died, and John Hancock then inherited what was said to be the greatest body of wealth in New England. And even though he's surrounded by loyalists, you know, because, you know, given his status and wealth, he was very much involved in the revolutionary politics, and his sentiments, even early on, were clearly for independence. You did mention that he was suspected of being a smuggler. In 1768, his sloop Liberty was impounded by customs officials on charge of running contraband goods. But a large group of private citizens, so you can tell he was very popular, a large group of private citizens stormed the customs post, burned the government boat, and beat the officers, causing them to seek refuge on a ship offshore. I mean, it sounds like Hancock was also very much at least abetted, if not outright aided, the Boston Tea Party. But, I mean, this is a guy that was wealthy. He put it all on the line for this country.
Yeah, you'd think he would have been a Tory with all the wealth that he had. But he wasn't, and he believed in freedom. And So taxation without representation, of course, was the idea that people were really infuriated by. But you can see how a merchant could see the profits of his voyages, taken away by the crown when they put these kinds of confiscatory taxation. So it's like a neat thing that appeared to be a luxury good. And tea is the great example, of course, that they imported. They tried to put a tariff on. And that was the taxation without the representation.
Yeah. Well, it just sounds to me like he was just really one of the most respected and admired men at the Second Continental Congress. Okay, let's go and take a break there. It's our annual 4th of July show. We're talking with Greg Leo. Stay with us. We'll have more on the signers of the Declaration of Independence.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
It is our annual 4th of July show, our 11th show, and we're talking with our regular guest for these shows, Greg Leo. He is a government consultant and civic activist, and you can find out more about him by heading to theleocompany.com. We'll link that up on ispyradio.com. And so we're talking today about the signers of the Declaration itself and just some of the more interesting ones. We just got done talking about John Hancock, and John Morton was actually the first signer to die after signing the Declaration. He had a long history in elected service, including both the First and the Second Continental Congresses, but his critical role was that he became known as the Keystone Vote for Independence, with Willing and Humphreys voting nay from the Pennsylvania delegation and Benjamin Franklin and James Wilson voting aye. It fell on John Morton to cast the deciding vote for independence, which he did, thus ensuring passage of the vote for independence. And so, Greg, what can you tell us a little bit about John Morton there?
Well, the Keystone vote was so critical because Pennsylvania, in a sense, was weak in terms of, deciding to, be independent. And so they called the Keystone State for that reason. If it had been Pennsylvania's choice not to engage here, you would have had a divided colonies. Yeah. And of course, much of the war was fought out in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. So it was really quite important. But there was really a lot of folks divided opinion, I'd say, in Pennsylvania. And so Morton played that key role at just the right place. He did not live long after he died in April of the next year. And he had contracted this inflammatory fever and died. And so it was the first to die. So it's almost like he was at the right place at the right time and then expired shortly thereafter. So,
well, he comes across as a little bit cautious and concerned about moving for independence. And he seems to be one of those people that certainly wanted independence, but he was concerned about what that actually meant. The war that would surely result from it and so on. And there's some rumors of him that even though that he was the Keystone vote there, some people try to say that he regretted his signing, and it's based on a letter by Benjamin Rush to General Anthony Wayne. But it's really the historians have misinterpreted the government that he was regretting. It was really about Pennsylvania's new government, not the move for independence.
Right. And so that is not an unreasonable idea. Who knew what would happen if you were truly independent? Would you become another monarchy? Would you bring in another king? Or, the idea, nobody had ever really revolted from a monarchy before. So this is the first time. And so a lot of people would wonder about that. And so Morton's idea is not unreasonable because it is not known. Now, after, of course, the American Revolution, other freedom-seeking people around the world saw the example and saw how it did work out positively for self-government, not without it being messy, because self-government is by definition messy. But the point is, though, they really set the trend. And so if you're a little bit tentative about something that's never been done before, that's not an unreasonable thing.
No, certainly especially when you're going up against the greatest power on earth. I mean, you have to have a little bit of reserve on that. So let's talk about Button Gwinnett. And this is the signer that was the second one to die. And Button has to be probably the most unusual named of the signers. As I said, he was the second to die, but it was a little bit unusual circumstances. He was from Georgia, a border state at the time, with Florida. which was controlled by Spain. Although he apparently attempted or planned to invade Florida, but it didn't quite work out. And he seems to have had a real chip on his shoulder and had some real political rivals. He ended up dying not from a battle in the Revolution, but rather a duel.
He died in a duel outside of Savannah, Georgia. And he was, served as the acting governor of Georgia for 2 months, then sought election and was not reelected. So he was a guy who was kind of prickly and difficult to work with. Mm-hmm. And his life was one of economic and political disappointment. Generally, he had aspirations to be the governor and, of course, to be reelected. And shortly thereafter, got in a conflict, had a duel, and was killed. So Button Gwinnett is a great trivia question. First of all, because, it's a great name. Secondly, he was the second one to die, and to show that not everybody who was in Philadelphia was there for high-minded ideas. Some of them might have been there just to be in power and to be, part of the new government that was pulling together.
Well, the reason that he had the duel was because a guy by the name of Lachlan McIntosh had addressed the Georgia Assembly denouncing Gwinnett in the harshest of terms, proclaiming him, quote, a scoundrel and a lying rascal. Gwinnett called on McIntosh to demand an apology or satisfaction. When McIntosh refused, Gwinnett challenged him to a duel. They were both wounded. The other guy, McIntosh, ended up surviving, but Gwinnett died a couple days later. I just look at that, and, I think honor and dignity was such a real thing for people back then, and probably far more so than today, in my opinion. I think of Cornwallis and his sense of honor, dignity, and just couldn't bring himself to surrender directly to these upstart rebels and Hicks at the Battle of Yorktown. So he sent his deputy not to surrender to Washington, but to surrender to the French commander. But that French commander, in turn, deferred to Washington, who, recognizing the slight there from Cornwallis, had his own deputy accept the sword. And, it's just interesting to see how honor really did mean an awful lot. So when they said that they pledged their honor, their sacred honor, they really meant it.
They really did mean it, and they really meant to back it up with their lives. And all I can say is I'm glad we don't have dueling today, because with the heat that's in normal politics today, you'd have lots of duels. So, of course, dueling ended as a practice after Aaron Burr killed Alexander Hamilton and became illegal throughout the country. And that's a good thing.
Yep. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. We'll have more with Greg Leo talking about the signers of the Declaration of Independence. Everyone stay with us. And welcome back. It is our annual 4th of July show here in our 11th year on iSpy Radio, and we're talking with our regular guests for these shows, Greg Leo. He's a government consultant and civic activist. You can find out more about him by going to theleocompany.com. So, Greg, in this segment, I thought we'd talk about the two Adamses that had signed the Declaration of Independence. You got Samuel Adams and John Adams. Why don't you go ahead and start us off?
Well, there were two really different ways of approaching public life and kind of civic engagement. Sam Adams, the rabble-rouser, would talk to the crowd. He was considered the firebrand of the Revolution, especially around the time of the Boston Tea Party and, the Sons of Liberty and the Liberty Tree. Samuel Adams, it was really an in-the-street type agitator. And that was what the situation may have required at that time to rally the people of Boston. John Adams, on the other hand, the careful, scholarly lawyer, represented the British who were involved in the Boston Massacre, got him off, which was pretty amazing, but much more about law and about process. So these two cousins represent two different approaches to civic life, which really you can see in people today, I think. You can see people who are more the rabble-rousing political activists, organizing people around issues. And then you can see the people who carefully work through processes, use the process of law and litigation and, legislation to try to change things. So the Adams, I think, really were the core of a great group of folks. He had Elderbridge Gerry there from Massachusetts as well. We talked about John Hancock, and of course, Robert Treat Paine. So it was the first place where they came to blows on the 18th of April and 1775 at Concord. And so it was a place, I think, that was kind of the point of the spear. The fact that they beat the British eventually and drove them from Boston tells a lot about the success of the Patriots who, you know, led the process in Massachusetts.
Hmm. In terms of Sam Adams, everybody knows him for his beer. Is that true that he was actually a brewer at the time, or is that just, you know, his name has been applied to a brewery?
It's been applied to a brewery, but it's great. I got to say, it's great marketing, and anything that brings more understanding of the revolutionary period, I lift the glass to.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's kind of funny. Sam Adams was really the brains behind the Continental Congress. You said that he's more kind of a rabble-rouser kind of guy, but he was really the one that had come up with the idea of a First Continental Congress, and it had appeared in a letter written and published by Samuel Adams on September 27th of 1773. So a full year before the actual First Continental Congress, he was out there proposing, hey, we need to start getting together. We need to start coming together as colonies, and we need to stand up to England.
The fact that there needs to be a better way, there needs to be a different kind of process, a different kind of future, is, you know, really the American way. So he brought a lot to it, but he was the guy that maybe started the fire of freedom, but was not the one that actually brought it through to the end. And so when you think more about John Adams, John Adams was really at every event, you know, at the early Republic. Of course, on the 50th anniversary of the Declaration signing was the day that he died and Jefferson died.
Yes.
Within the day. And the courier that went from John Adams carrying the news of his death met at the Independence Hall in Philadelphia. So John Adams and you know, Thomas Jefferson really are the two seminal people, I think, in this whole event. And of course, we're the ones that were largely responsible for writing the document.
You know, John Adams has always been a little bit of a puzzle to me. To me, he comes off as kind of an extreme Federalist. You know, he was, of course, the second president. And it just sometimes, you know, looking at him, it really seems like he reverted to the ways of the king, where he's targeting his political enemy, thinks that he could use the halls of justice and the halls of government to do that. He's famous for passing the Alien and Sedition Act. And you know, we kind of see that really with some of the Democrats that are in power today, that they really want to use government to punish their adversaries. What was it about him later in life, after having signed the Declaration of Independence, after having broken with the King of England, why did he seem to go full bore Supreme Federalist?
Well, I think he saw the power in a strong federal government. And of course, that was one of the largest arguments for, you know, the Constitution and pulling it together. But I think you're right. I think he was very draconian in some ways. But the contrast between, you know, his kind of federalism and, you know, populism was, you know, worked out in that most important of elections after George Washington left the scene, probably one of the most bitter elections in American history. Between, you know, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. And so what caused that? I think basically he saw how power was used, and he knew that there are like structures of power, of law, and that, you know, he didn't forgive or forget, which is kind of a New England trait in some ways.
He was very much a political creature, wasn't he?
Absolutely. And of course, a fabulous book written about him. The McCullough book on John Adams goes into great detail about how complex he was and complicated. But I think the fact that the country is built on rule of law is largely a testament to, you know, the kind of idea that he brought forward. And of course, anybody who could stand toe to toe with Abigail deserves a lot of credit in some ways.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah. Well, let's go ahead and take a break a little bit early here, because we've got just our last segment. We'll wrap things up about the signers of the Declaration with Greg Leo. Stay with us. And welcome back into our final segment now on our annual 4th of July show. This is our 11th year. And we're talking with our regular guest for these shows, Greg Leo. He is a government consultant and civic activist. You can find out more about him and the work that he does at theleocompany.com. We'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. And but, you know, before we leave John Adams, I found a really fascinating story talking, you know, going back to the Olive Branch petition. And in the middle of them sending the delegation to England and whatnot, it turns out that there was a letter that was confiscated because, of course, you know, Britain controlled the postal service at the time. There was a confiscated letter written by John Adams to James Warren on July 24th, 1775. So shortly after the Olive Branch petition was put forward and signed and get ready to send off. The letter revealed detailed plans for war while also mentioning the Olive Branch petitions. And it really looks like because he's essentially leaking that they're planning for war despite working on the petition, it really undermined the petition's success. But it was actually published over in England on September 17th. But it really just demonstrated that, you know, on the one hand, they're talking peace, but and they already had plans to fight the British despite the petition for peace. And so a lot of people were saying it was just it really maybe had sabotaged the whole Olive Branch petitions. But it's interesting. And, you know, that's why I said earlier that John Adams, I think, was just a real creature of politics. I think that, you know, he was willing to say one thing to one crowd and another thing to another crowd. And, you know, maybe I'm reading that wrong, but that's how he comes across.
It is political and sometimes a negotiating tactic to show both the carrot and the stick. But in politic, if you're actually offering an olive branch, you don't talk about, you know, taking more forceful action. So, yeah. And unfortunately, but, you know, luckily the mail was slow and largely the king had already made up his mind by the time that letter came out. But, you know, I just wanted to kind of segue to who these people are and what they, you know, what they sacrificed. So when they pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor, they really meant it. And So of the 56 that were, you know, signers, five were captured by the British. They were tortured and murdered, five of the 56. 12 had their homes burnt by the British in the course of the war, ransacked, and sometimes even by Tories, by, you know, colonial folks who were still loyal to the king. Two lost their sons in the war. You know, two had their sons captured. And when you're captured in the Revolutionary War, a lot of times you were put in a prison ship and just locked in the hold of a leaky wooden vessel out in the harbor for months and in some cases years. Nine of the 56 fought in the war and, you know, died in the Revolutionary War. So of these 56, they walked the walk of freedom. And it wasn't just about signing the declaration. It was about backing that up with what you have to do to make sure that you are truly free.
Yes.
And so, as Americans, I think we owe a real debt of gratitude to those who signed it, signed the document, which is a living document today. And, you know, actually made sure that we were free. Thanks to the French, we were free when it finally mattered.
Yep, absolutely right. And, you know, I've said it even very recently on the show, is that you only have the freedoms that you're willing to fight for. And I think all of these men certainly prove that. You mentioned people being tortured and whatnot. Richard Stockton was one of those. And it was interesting, New Jersey was overrun by the British in November of 76. So this is just, you know, 4 months after signing the declaration. He managed to move his family to safety, but he was captured and imprisoned by the British. Originally, he was taken to one jail and then moved over to Provost Prison in New York, where he was intentionally starved and subjected to freezing cold weather. He ended up dying of lip cancer, of all things, before the war was finished. And, you know, like you said, these people really endured a lot to give us our freedoms, and we really do owe them a debt of gratitude. One of the other people that we probably ought to talk about is Jefferson. He was the lead author of the Declaration of Independence, but he wasn't even originally a delegate to the Second Continental Congress. As we had mentioned earlier, President Peyton Randolph was summoned back to Virginia within 2 weeks to preside over the House of Burgesses, and Thomas Jefferson was the one that replaced him.
And really, fortunately so, because he was one of the most brilliant men of his time and was a magnificent writer. And so many of the memorable phrases that we have in the Declaration really came from Thomas Jefferson.
Yes.
And of all of his accomplishments, he listed them on his gravestone there at Monticello there in Virginia. And President of the United States is not one of them. The Declaration is, the Virginia right of religious freedom is, the founder of the University of Virginia is listed, but the presidency of the United States, which he was a significant president, is not listed. And I think that tells you a lot about Jefferson, that he's a man of ideas, an enlightened man at a time of great change.
Yeah. I would like to talk to you sometime about, you know, the fact that here he is a slave owner, and yet he was such a moving, driving force behind the Declaration of Independence and such stirring words about freedom and liberty. But we're just going to have to save that for another time. The last one I'd like to talk to you about is Charles Carroll, and he was the last to die of the signers. I mean, just think of the tremendous changes he saw in those 56 years after the Declaration was signed. But, you know, I really don't know an awful lot about him. What can you tell us?
Well, I'm looking him up here, but I believe that he's from Maryland.
Yes.
And so the in Maryland, remember, it's different state because it's primarily Catholic. And so, as you know, the Catholic kind of leadership in Maryland didn't think the same way that a lot of the Puritan, leadership might in Massachusetts. And so the Calvins, all the folks that are from the Carrolls, they really were the dominant family in Maryland. And Maryland is, of course, a transitional state, very maritime oriented, but also a bit of the South as well. So I can only say that, Charles Carroll was key because Maryland had to be one of the areas. And of course, the national capital was carved out of Maryland eventually when it was time to create the Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Well, we are up against the clock. Greg, as always, this has been really fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us, and have a great 4th of July.
Thank you. And celebrate your freedom.
Absolutely. You probably haven't heard the name John Dickinson. In 1767 and 68, he became famous after publishing his Letters from a Farmer in Pennsylvania to the Inhabitants of the British Colonies, which appeared in many colonial newspapers. In fact, he was often referred to as the penman of the Revolution. But you haven't heard of him because when his pen was needed most, he bailed and refused to sign the Declaration of Independence. Those who did sign the Declaration weren't perfect, but that doesn't mean you tear down statues or try to write them out of history. It's a reminder that even imperfect men can do extraordinary things and be the perfect men for the job, and rightfully remembered. Thank you for joining us today. Have a great 4th of July, and be thankful for those signers of the Declaration. There are links on today's show page at iSpyRadio.com if you want to explore these men more and some of the events that we talked about. And pass this along, will you? Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.